Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have open phone lines for that hour, and as long as our internet connection stays connected, which it didn't briefly yesterday, I'm not sure really why, we can have a solid hour of conversation over the issues you raise with your questions about the Bible or the Christian faith. Or if you want to raise an issue to discuss that you disagree with the host about, that's welcome too. Feel free to call. Here's the number to call. It's 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our first caller today is Jonathan, who's calling us from Canada. Jonathan, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, Steve. I had a question about basically two things together. One is the Chronicles of Narnia, fantasy witch literature with, you know, Christian stuff mixed in. And basically, my own background is I really enjoyed reading and listening to the Chronicles of Narnia. And for a while prior to that, I hadn't listened to it before because I was kind of hesitant about it. And I used to be really legalistic and strict with myself. And eventually got around to understanding about Romans 14 and, you know, that sort of balance about the weak and the strong brother and so forth. So I want to get your thoughts on, does C.S. Lewis go too far with the Chronicles of Narnia? And is there anything comparable in the Bible with what C.S. Lewis is doing with, you know, incorporating fantasy elements and myths and maybe even things like in the Bible itself, like where Jesus may refer to a Jewish folklore or some kind of hypothetical situation, or Paul using the example on Mars Hill of the unknown God and quoting certain literature. What are your thoughts on that, and what would you see as sort of the thresholds of how far those things should be taken?
All right. Well, actually, those examples you gave are, of course, not precisely like the parallels to C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. I don't have any problem with the Chronicles of Narnia. I have known Christians who thought it was wrong to use scenarios that have witches and magic and pagan god-like things and nymphs and pans and centaurs and things like that from paganism. They thought it was wrong to use those in such stories. The stories, however, are fantasy stories, and they're not advocating paganism or witchcraft. In fact, I don't think that the Chronicles of Narnia would cause anyone who reads them to say, you know, I think I'd like to become a witch, or I'd like to become a magician or a sorcerer. I don't even think the Chronicles hold out that option to people. But you see, as he's making allegories of Christian truth, especially in The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, the other Chronicles don't follow as closely along a clear Christian gospel message, but they do have Christian ideas in them. But in order to have something happen like the lion who is killed comes back to life, if you're not going to have that overtly Christian and have, you know, well, God raised him, you're going to have some other kind of supernatural element in the story. And since Lewis, you know, is writing a fantasy story, and, you know, he uses magic as the explanation for this. But just as, Jesus is not a literal lion named Aslan, so Jesus was not raised by magic either. But within the milieu of the story, magic works to explain something supernatural happening. But it's not like a story that's, realistic magic or realistic witchcraft or anything like that. It's not advocating those things. It's simply using them in a storyline. Now, does the Bible, you know, tell any stories like that that aren't, connected to reality? Well, maybe. You mentioned Jesus using perhaps parables that don't necessarily reflect reality. Many people think that that's what Jesus did when he used the story of Lazarus and the rich man, that he was borrowing a story from the Pharisees, who the rabbinic teachers had stories very much like that, and that Jesus was borrowing one, and that the scenario of the story was, in fact, fantastic and not necessarily corresponding to reality, but it worked as a milieu for making his point. In the Old Testament, in Judges chapter 9, Gideon's son, Abimelech, has killed all of his brothers except one, and he's made himself king over the people of Shechem and trying to assert his kingship over all of Israel. And his only surviving brother rebukes the people of Shechem for embracing Abimelech as their king, and he tells a story about how the trees went out to find a king for themselves, and they asked various trees to help them, and each of these trees said, you know, why should I leave what I'm doing? I'm producing fruit, I'm producing good wood, I'm doing things that people value, and why should I go leave this behavior in order to go and be a king over the trees? I mean, the subtext obviously is the trees obviously don't need a king. Trees don't do anything that need to be governed by other trees. And likewise, the subtext was that Israel didn't need Abimelech or any other man being their king, since God was their king. They didn't have any need for him. And in the story where the trees are talking to each other and imploring each other to become king over the trees and so forth, obviously this is not a realistic scenario. Trees don't talk like that. They don't talk at all. It's more what we would call a fable. Aesop's fables, for example, have animals that talk and trees that talk and so forth. That's what fables do. And that's what a fable is. It's not like a parable, which is true to life usually, but it's it takes a very unrealistic, contrary to nature, kind of a element, and weaves it into a moral tale like Aesop's fables did. So the Bible does have examples of that, and one could suggest that what C.S. Lewis has done in the Chronicles of Narnia is something perhaps not dissimilar. So that might be, now how far should we go with it? I don't know exactly how far we should go. I don't actually use those images myself. I don't have that strategy.
There's a Christian writer, I think it was Clement, and he had a letter to the Corinthians, and he actually made reference to a mythical phoenix. When I saw that the first time, I was like, oh yeah, no wonder this isn't in the Bible, you know? But maybe I've gone too far, maybe in judging Clement with using that example.
Well, Clement actually did apparently believe in the phoenix. He spoke of it as if it really existed, and well, maybe he didn't believe in it, but many students of Clement of Rome believe that he did believe in the phoenix, and he was using it as an example of resurrection, of death and resurrection. Now, you're right, the phoenix is a mythical beast, bird, and if Clement really believed there was such a phoenix in some foreign land, he said it was in a faraway land, and he had only heard reports, so he didn't know that it wasn't true. But, you know, if he did believe there was a phoenix that was in existence, well, then obviously he was not an inspired writer, and he doesn't claim to be. Anyone can make a mistake. But maybe he did know. Maybe he did know that the phoenix is a mythological character, in which case he nonetheless used it as an example of death and resurrection.
Okay, I guess one other quick related question to this. Is Leviathan in the Bible to be taken literally? Because I think I've read some writings elsewhere which show that maybe this represented like chaos in other cultures and other literatures. Where do you stand on Leviathan?
Well, in the book of Psalms, Leviathan is taken up as a symbol for Egypt. And it seems to be what also Ezekiel 32 has in mind, where the dragon in the sea is, Egypt is compared to a dragon in the sea. And there was this idea in certain mythologies of a seven-headed dragon that lived in the sea. Now, on the other hand, there is a one-headed creature, probably, described in Job. And where God is speaking of Leviathan, he's telling Job to consider this animal and speaks of it as if it's a real animal. And it is mixed in with other real animals, like horses and eagles and things like that, other real animals that Job was familiar with. And the way God brings up Behemoth and Leviathan, he does so as if these were animals with which Job was also familiar. Now, we don't have a name for, we don't know what animal it was that was called Leviathan. the description of him in Job appears to be that of a, I guess what we'd call a dragon or a dinosaur. And so, you know, it seems to me there really was a creature like that that Job was acquainted with, that he had seen them before. But it's not surprising that such a creature might become an emblem of another nation like Egypt or someone scary like that. A monstrous creature could represent an intimidating nation. And so that Leviathan would become a symbol in the Psalms and Ezekiel, a symbol of, and Isaiah also mentions Leviathan in chapter 27, verse 1, becomes a symbol of Egypt, is not really much different than the fact that in modern times a bear becomes a symbol of the Soviet Union, back when there was a Soviet Union. Maybe a bear would still represent Russia today. An eagle represent America. A lion representing Britain and so forth. So it's not uncommon for real animals to be taken up as symbols of certain kingdoms. In Daniel's vision of the four kingdoms that came out of the Gentile world, he compared Babylon to a lion and Media Persia to a bear and Alexander the Great's Grecian Empire to a leopard. And the Roman Empire was likened to a fearsome creature with iron teeth and ten horns. And so, you know, there really aren't any creatures with 10 horns, but there really are lions and bears and leopards. And so we can see that real animals sometimes are taken up in modern times as well as in the Bible to represent nations. And therefore, I think Leviathan was a real animal, but it is used sometimes in symbolic passages to represent Egypt.
Okay, Steve, thank you very much. I'll let you get to your next call.
Okay, Jonathan. Thanks for your call. Let's talk to, looks like Jan from Connecticut next. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Somebody recommended your website to me several months ago, and I've been listening to it every day. And I got to the part that talked about mental illness, and I'm quite concerned about what kind of effect this could have on other people, because I have bipolar disorder, and it really shook me up.
Okay.
I feel
and,
like.
And what was it? What was it about my lectures that shook you up about that?
Well, I'm 61 years old, and I've had it since I've been in my teens, and I'm better. I'm more healthy now than I've ever been in my life. And I know
Great.
A lot of it has to do with the time I've been spending with the Lord. But some of it has to do with the chemical imbalance and some of the medication I'm on. And, you know, I got off the phone and I was like calling my friends and I'm like, am I supposed to go off my medication now because I'm so close to the Lord? And, you know, now I don't need my medication anymore. And they're like, Dan, just calm down. I've also worked in.
Well, if you were listening to my lectures carefully, you'll know that I never, and I said this, I never recommend people to go off their medication, because first of all, that's not mine to do. I don't know anything about their physical condition. I don't know to what degree there might be a chemical or physical cause to the problems they're having, and for me to simply give blanket permission for somebody or a command that people should get off their medication would be outrageous. I mean, I would never do that, and I always try to make that clear. I have my objections to many of the medications that are used to treat certain mental issues, and I have concerns about some of the careless ways in which mental illness is diagnosed without really any kind of scientific basis. That just based on not usually based on blood tests or other physical factors. Many times a psychiatrist will simply tell you that you've got schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or something like that based on talking to you. And, without you doing any kind of scientific testing. What I say is that I believe that most mental disorders, and maybe it's not most, but I think it is, that most of the things people go to professionals for, whether they're going to psychiatrists or psychologists. Most of the things they go to them for have a spiritual component that is addressed in Scripture, whether it's anxiety or anger or, you know, fear or relationship problems or depression. I mean, those things are addressed in Scripture, and they are treated there, since they didn't have medications back then. They are treated as, you know, things that have a spiritual component, and I believe they do. But to say that does not mean that it would be safe for somebody who's been on medications all their life to simply stop taking them. That can be very dangerous. I mean, a body develops a dependency on chemicals and things that are put into it in many cases. And so I wouldn't be encouraging you to go off your medication. But I would say, I mean, you did say that as you've gotten closer to the Lord, you know, your situation has improved, which would tend to confirm to me that there is a spiritual component. But that doesn't mean that you can do something rash like just, you know, flush your medications down the toilet, because that can be dangerous. So I would suggest that if you feel you're improving, that whoever's prescribing your medications, your doctor or whatever, you could consult them and or her and say, you know, is there any way we can try to wean off of these medications and see if I don't need them as much as I seemed to before.
Right. Well, I know there is such a thing as generational sin. I know my mother had it, and my son has it, and probably my grandfather had it. My mother hung herself when I was 19 from it, and you know, but then I'm saying, you know, it could be generational sin too. So,
well, if it is, that would be a spiritual component too.
Exactly.
When I say that most issues that people go to counselors for have a spiritual component, I don't mean that they always have the same spiritual component. It could be demonic, in some cases. It could be unresolved guilt. It can be other spiritual things. It could be disobedient. It could be a conscience that isn't clear. I mean, there's different things in different cases that can cause people such troubles. And taking a medication may only mask it, and the spiritual problem may remain unchanged. But the medication, you know, brings some relief, and so the person thinks, wow, I'm better now. And maybe they are. I mean, if a person's problems are caused by something physical, let's say a thyroid imbalance or hypoglycemia or some literally a physical component, then medication are actually, you know, physical medicines are recommended. The thing is that too many times.
Do you not believe that the chemical imbalance in the brain could be part of it?
There are chemical imbalances in some people's brains. In fact, even monthly, on a monthly cycle, women, especially in their, you know, premenopausal times, have very big changes in the chemistry of their brains at different times of the month and so forth. And there are other things that can cause that too. But the point here is that many people who've been given psychiatric medications have been given them without any doctor determining through any scientific test whether there is a chemical imbalance or not. For example, whatever medications they're giving you, you don't need to tell me what they are, but I used to know what they used to give to bipolar people, you know, years ago. I imagine they have newer medications now. They used to give lithium primarily. But let's say back when they gave lithium, there was never a doctor who really believed, at least I don't think there was a doctor who really believed, because it wasn't the case, you know, that a patient had a lithium deficiency. In other words, that the body needs lithium, and they were, you know, and this person's body had less than they needed, so they were giving them some more lithium. Lithium is not something that has a function in the body. It's a contaminant in the body, like lead. It's a mineral salt that is slightly toxic, like lead, and it gets into our bodies through the, you know, water and air and things like that we ingest. So, you know, lithium is in our bodies. And it may even have some impact on the way our brains function, but it's not a nutrient. It's not something the body generates or uses. And so no one has ever really had a lithium deficiency, just like I think nobody has ever had an alcohol deficiency. If somebody's in great pain getting their leg cut off because they have, gangrene, it used to be commonplace to give people a pint of whiskey, you know. Well, not because this person did not have an alcohol deficiency in their body, but the addition of the drug had a pain-relieving, effect. So also the drugs that they give for psychiatric diagnoses, almost never that I've ever heard of, have been given to redress some deficiency in the brain, some imbalance that needs to be checked. It's rather, in most cases, the doctors don't even know why the drug works. They just know that the pharmaceutical company has said, we have found that people who have this particular problem, when they take this particular medicine that we've developed and sell, that it has a calming effect or a good effect upon them. And in many cases, the pharmaceutical companies don't even know why it is, because it's not like they're producing a chemical that your body needs or regularly would have. It's an addition of something, like when I said, like when you add alcohol. Alcohol isn't something your body needs, but it does have an effect of killing pain, for example. And there are, there are other drugs that one can take that will do so, but that doesn't mean that they had a deficiency in those areas. So to say someone has a chemical imbalance and that the doctor's given you a medication to redress that imbalance, I would question that. There may be some cases where they do that, but I have known very few, and almost everyone I know who's under psychiatric care was diagnosed without anything like a blood test or anything to actually see if there was a chemical imbalance. They just heard what the person was going through and just assumed this must be, a chemical imbalance. We know that this pharmaceutical that this company sells us and gives me bonuses for recommending, it helps people like this sometimes. So anyway, I'm not saying you shouldn't be taking meds, and especially if you've been taking them all your life. I'd be the last person to tell you to stop. But I would say that you might easily come to a place where you don't need them, but you'd have to have the doctor wean you from them because your body is no doubt very much dependent upon them right now.
Okay, and it may thank
be,
you.
And it may be that you'd never be without them. But the main thing is that a lot of these psychotropic drugs, they have possible side effects which are not desirable. All other things being equal, I'd much rather not be taking the drug if I were given the choice. Now, if I can't control myself, and if I've got a problem that's out of my control, maybe all things aren't equal. Maybe I should take a medication. But most of the things that they give for psychiatric problems are not really properly medications. They're not treating a sickness. There's no physical system in the body that's been tested to see if it's ill. It's strictly the person's behavior and mental activity that's being interpreted by the psychiatrist, and he happens to know a handful or more of chemicals that if you put in a person, it might change those things. But no one knows why. It's not like an antibiotic which helps to destroy bacteria or something. It's just something that has an effect on the way the brain works. In fact, in some cases, many of the drugs they give for psychotherapy or psychiatric, not psychotherapy, but psychiatric treatments, they actually disable part of the brain. That's how they work. The brain is too active in the frontal lobe or something, and so they kind of cut off the synapses, almost like a lobotomy. What's that?
It's called serotonin reuptake.
Right, right. And there are psychiatrists who say, that it damages the brain function, but they say the damage is the cure for this person. This person's got a problem, and you got to do this damage to their brain. But it's a shame if that person who is having their brain damaged in that way, if it were possible for that person to have relief through some other means because, let us say, their problems have more of a spiritual cause than physical. It'd be a shame that they're actually doing this to their brain. But it's this is something that I don't give counsel about going off medications, but I would say that if your problem has a spiritual element at its root, which I suspect most cases do, then it may be possible for your doctor eventually to take you off the meds. That'd be his judgment or hers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. That's something definitely I'm going to look into in the, you know, in the future. Right now, I'm just still shook up from the listening to the listening to your teaching on it. I'm just concerned for other people too. You know. If they need something.
Well, I am too. That's why I gave the teaching on it. I'm concerned about other people too, because some people are greatly damaged by these medications. You know, I knew somebody who was given some psychiatric medications by a doctor, and, you know, she got motion disorder that lasted for years and years. And she's kind of getting better now, but it was caused by the neuroleptic drugs that they gave her. And so there are some... the way I see it, if I can't manage my life very well, I should look into, first of all, any of the spiritual reasons that might be a problem to me. And the Bible has a lot of information about that. And a good spiritual Christian counselor, a pastor who knows the Word of God, can often discern what's going on there from a conversation or two, from knowing you. But... you know, if it comes down to using meds, well, then that's what it comes down to. But it's like if I was out of control so that I was a dangerous person, the real desirable object would be for me to get myself under control so I don't have to be a danger to people. But if I can't do that or don't do that, then a straitjacket might be a better solution. Not that straitjackets are a normative solution to people's behavior problems. They're more of an extreme solution. And I think that a lot of times these drugs function as a chemical straitjacket. I didn't make that term up. Psychiatrists actually made up that term. They call them chemical straitjackets sometimes. So, you know, a straitjacket is good if you can't get under control some other way. But if you can, I'd prefer to be without the straitjacket myself. In any case, I'm just trying to keep a balanced look at this. I don't have anything. I don't have any knowledge of your physical or chemical, state, so I can't tell you what to do or not to do with the medications. But I can tell you that I believe that if you could do without them and manage your life through the Holy Spirit, you know, the Bible says if we walk in the Spirit, we will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Our lives will be will have the fruit of the Spirit: love and joy and peace and gentleness and self-control and faithfulness and all these things. These are the things that the Spirit produces if we walk in the Spirit. Not everyone does that well, but right. that'd be what I would be wanting to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad I got to talk to you.
All right. I appreciate your calling. I know that you tried to communicate with me through Facebook, but, you know, we need to have more of a conversation like this in order to even get anything ironed out here. I need to take another call, though, before I'm out of time. I appreciate your call, Jan, and say hi to Joe for me.
I will.
Okay.
I will. Thank you.
God bless you. Her pastor, Joe, is a pastor of Calvary Chapel in Connecticut, and he is a guy that in 1975, I and some friends picked him up hitchhiking. He was a hippie, and we picked him up hitchhiking and led him to the Lord. And then he went back home to his home in Connecticut and started a Calvary Chapel. I think he's got about 1,000 people in his congregation. And she, Jan, who we were just talking to, had instant messaged me on Facebook and saying she wanted to talk about this subject. I said she should call the show, but she mentioned she's in his church, which is kind of cool. He's a really neat guy. Let's talk next to... Paul from Sacramento. Paul, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you for having me on your show. I've been listening to you for about 6 months now, and I really respect your answers. I'm a chaplain at my church, And I got married to a wonderful lady about 2 years ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. She became a Christian about 5 years ago. You know, she just loves the Lord and on fire for Christ.
Great.
The question I have, she has a 20-year-old daughter and a 17-year-old son. And, you know, she actually was in the occult, Wicca, before she became a Christian and, you know, learned about Christ. And so the kids were kind of raised like that. Since we've been married, you know, I've sat down with them. We've had a lot of really good talks about the Bible and Christ. But they're very analytical, and there's a lot of, you could tell, resistance in it. The question I have for you, she stumped me the other day. We were sitting there talking, and she said, Paul, if Christ is all-knowing, knows everything, and full of love, so he already knows everything that's going to happen, everything's been predetermined, he says, how could he have created Satan and allowed all this stuff if he knew that all these things were going to happen through eternity, you know, with the devil and all the evil? Why did he allow him to be created? And especially, he had him at his right hand, man. I mean, he was, you know, his top angel. And you know what? She stumped me. I sat there and I said, honey, that's a good question. And I thought of you, and I was listening to you, and I thought that maybe you could help me come up with an answer for her.
Well, that's a very large subject, and you probably know that I talk a long time even about smaller subjects. So a big subject like this, I could take a very long time. Let me start out by saying that the devil exists because God has use for him. And we know that because God is going to get rid of him at some point when he has no more use for him. God is sovereign. The devil has no innate right to exist if God doesn't want him to. He doesn't even have the ability to attack us unless God lets him, according to the book of Job. The devil really is on God's leash. The devil is not friendly toward God, nor God toward him. But he is nonetheless given a short leash, as it were, by God, who, you know, when the devil wants to hurt Job, he has to ask God's permission. And God says, well, you can do this much, but you can't do any more. You know, it's like Satan's totally under God's orders. Now, you mentioned that he was God's, you know, chief angel. This is the standard and long-standing traditional view of Satan. But actually, when you study out the passages that people use to support this idea that Satan was an angel, a good angel, and he fell, you're going to have to look at Isaiah 14, 12 through 15. You're going to have to look at Ezekiel 28, 12 and following, and very few other passages, just those two primarily, and maybe a few others that are thought to hint at this. And you'll find that they don't really teach that clearly. There is no clear teaching in the Bible that Satan was a good angel. He might have been, but it's not clearly taught in Scripture. And there are some people who think that Satan was made exactly as he is to do exactly what he's doing, namely to test people. The Bible says that silver is tested in the refining pot, but God tests the hearts of men. Now, the testing agent he uses is the tester or the tempter, Satan. The word tester and tempter are the same word in the Greek and the Hebrew. So Satan is the tester, and he tested Adam and Eve. You know, people sometimes wonder, why did God allow there to be the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the Garden of Eden? That just caused all kinds of trouble. Well, that's just the point. God didn't have to make such a tree if he didn't want to. And if he did want to, he could have put it on the other side of the world where Adam and Eve would never encounter it. And he wouldn't even have had to put them in the same garden where the serpent was. He could have them in a different universe. Why in the world did God put Adam and Eve right in a garden where there was this tree and this serpent and this test for them? Well, we have to assume it's because God wanted them to be tested. And why would he want that? Because he's looking for loyal followers, loyal friends, loyal children that he can entrust with the ruling of the universe. If the Bible says if we endure, we will reign with him. But we have to endure the tests, because if you're going to reign with God, I mean, if you're going to give somebody responsibility over the universe, they better be the right stuff, you know? They better be the kind of stuff that's suitable to reign over the universe. So when God made Adam and Eve, remember what he said? Let's make man and we'll give him dominion over all the things we've made, over the animals, the fish, the sea, and so forth. That's what God made man for, is to rule over the creation under God. But they had to be tested, because if they weren't loyal to God, well, they can't be entrusted with a lot of responsibility if they're not going to be loyal. And they did fall. And before God gives us complete, authority to reign with Christ in the resurrection, he's going to make sure that we qualify, that we're not going to be disloyal. And that's what the tester is there for. Remember in Deuteronomy 13, the opening three or four verses, Moses is warning the people of Israel about the false prophets that would come. And he says, if there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder which he gives you comes to pass, but he tells you to come and worship other gods, he says, don't follow that prophet or dreamer of dreams, because the Lord your God is testing you to see if you love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. Now, that's an interesting thing, because he describes a false prophet leading the children of Israel to worship demons, obviously a demonically inspired prophet, and even able to do signs and wonders. So apparently demonically empowered prophet. And Moses says, when that prophet does that, if he tries to lead you astray, don't go there, because the Lord your God is testing you. In other words, by even allowing the children of Israel to encounter such a prophet with such convincing signs and so forth, God is allowing them to be tested, their loyalty to him. You see, Eve, when she was told by the serpent that, you know, if you eat this fruit, you'll be like God, knowing good and evil, she had the choice. Does she want to be loyal to God, or does she want to rebel against God? She could have said, well, you know, even if that's true, I'm on God's side. You know, he made me. He made me. He owns me. He's got every right to tell me what to do. And he said, don't do it. So even if you're right about that, Satan, I'm not going to do it, because I'm on God's side. I'm loyal to him. But instead, she decided to rebel. And that's exactly what Moses was warning the children of Israel about. If a false prophet comes and does spectacular things and dazzles you and says, let's go worship other gods, the Israelites are supposed to say, well, wait a minute, you know, that's very impressive and all that, but we're serving Yahweh. We're not serving those other gods. And God, in this way, is testing people. Now, every human being on the planet is tested. Every human being on the planet has the potential to pass the tests and to reign with Christ someday. And unfortunately, of course, God knows that many would fail the test, but they have to be tested anyway. Some people say, well, if God knew they'd fail, why give them the test? Well, that's silly. If you didn't give them the test, they wouldn't fail. So, I mean, he wouldn't know that they would fail if there wasn't going to be a test, because they weren't going to fail. It's not as if God has predetermined everything. It's just that I believe he knows what the future holds. He knows that certain amount of people who are tested are going to fail the test. But it's not, you know, it's not his responsibility to say, okay, so I won't make them at all. Well, then why? Why wouldn't you? Because those people then would not be tested, would not fail. You know, why not give them a chance? People do have a chance. I believe everyone has a chance. Everyone can be loyal to God or not. Every person, I believe, by instinct knows there's a creator, until they drive that thought out of their head with the most irrational arguments and become atheists, you know. But everyone intuitively knows, if they're not stupid, that there's a God, that something made us. And even if they don't know who that God is, they might not know anything about Jesus or Yahweh, they know there's a God, and everyone has the choice to pursue that God, to say, you know, whoever made me owns me. And whoever owns me, I should be finding out what they made me for, and I should do it. In other words, a person, it only takes a rational person to get that far in their reasoning. And if somebody gets that far and says, I'm going to seek to know this creator of mine, I believe that God will intervene to let them find him, you know, if they seek him. But people who don't even bother to think that way, people say, well, I don't care about any God who may have made me. I'm my own. No one can tell me what to do. I'm going to seek my own way. Well, they're failing the test, you know, and it's their own choice because they could make the other choice if they wanted to. I believe that God does know what choices people are going to make, and he grieves. Remember how he grieved over Jerusalem, and he wept over Jerusalem because of their rejection of him, and he knew what was going to come upon them. You know, he's not happy about it, but there has to be a legitimate test. If God said, okay, in my foreknowledge, I can see that, you know, this percentage of people on earth are going to fail the test, so I just won't make them. Well, then what he's done is simply decided that he'll only make people who will be loyal to him, which is all the same as, you know, guaranteeing people's loyalty. And a loyalty that's guaranteed by God isn't worth much. I mean, he wants us to choose to be loyal to him, just like I want my wife to choose to be faithful to me. If I suspect that she might not want to be, and I put bodyguards around her 24/7 so that she couldn't do anything wrong, well, she'd be faithful to me, but it wouldn't mean anything, you know. Now my wife doesn't need that kind of guarding, but I have known wives who did, you know, but it wouldn't mean anything. Keep them faithful by force, that's not what God does. He gives us the chance to make our own choices, and then we are either blameworthy or commendable for the choices we make. And this is what we have to. We got to look at our adult children. My adult children, not all of them are making choices I wish they would make. And I think sometimes I wish God, you know, would do more to make them do the right thing. But then they wouldn't be humans. People have to take responsibility for their own choices, and God knows what they're going to do, but he didn't determine it. Knowing something's going to happen doesn't mean you're making it happen.
Well, that's a great analogy. I understand a lot more where you're going with that. That's maybe a great way to go at her with that. She's a thinker. She's very analytical, and she stopped me with that.
Well, these radio programs are archived on the website. She can listen to it if you want her to.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Okay, Paul, I appreciate your call, and God bless you and your family.
All right. Bye.
All right. Bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Dennis from West Sacramento, California. Dennis, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I called once before, but this is my second call. And I come in the middle of your conversation with a guy that was asking about, I think it was the four-headed beast that was mentioned in one of the prophecies.
Well, and the person was asking actually about Leviathan. Yeah.
Leviathan, yeah. He was talking about that too, but then I heard something about the four-headed beast, I knew a guy that was a real good scholar, and he did a study on that, and he determined that that four-headed beast going through the wilderness was the tribes of Israel. There was four major tribes. One was Judah, that was the lion. The other was, I believe, Dan, that was the eagle. They had flags that were emblems, and
yeah, actually, I'm not really aware of a four-headed beast in the Bible. There's a seven-headed beast.
Yeah, they also had a four-headed beast, too.
Where was that? Where was that found?
I'm not sure the where it come from, but
I see. If we don't have a passage to consider, then we can't. Yeah, if we had actually.
And the four major ones was a man.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about the cherubim that have four faces. Yeah, the four faces, one of an eagle, one of a man, one of a lion, and one of an ox. Yeah, Ezekiel saw cherubim, and they didn't have four heads, as near as I can tell. They just had four faces hanging off the four sides of their head. And the interpretation of that, there's been multiple interpretations of that. But you're right, the four banners that the four leading tribes of Israel carried are thought traditionally to have had those four faces on them. So I think that's what you're getting at there. Yeah, I appreciate your call. Okay, let's talk to Sarah from Sacramento next. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was calling, actually, in regards to the lady that you were talking to before. I actually did come into the middle of the conversation where you were talking about that she was on some kind of drugs or some kind of medications.
Uh-huh.
So I was I was a little bit disturbed about how you addressed that you can – I understand that there's a lot of spiritual aspect of that, but a lot of people that are on those kind of medications are trying to get off in terms of they don't want to be on them. And then the problem is that they should be on them, and they're trying to find a way to get off. And so by you saying that, well, you should get off of them, it causes them to get off of medications when actually...
Well, I hope you won't ever tell anybody that I told someone to get off their medications, because that's exactly what I didn't tell them. And in fact, I was very adamant that I would never tell anyone to get off their medications. So I hope you won't represent me as having said the opposite of what I said.
Okay. I just was... Maybe it's because I came into the conversation halfway. I just was a little bit disturbed by, that's what it sounded like to me, like you said, so I'm sorry.
No, well, yeah, you missed part of it. What I said is that many of the things that people go to counselors for, including psychologists and psychiatrists, are problems that the Bible addresses as spiritual issues.
Yeah.
And because of being spiritual issues, they can be managed through spiritual means. I said that if a person will not manage them through spiritual means and they don't get under control that way, then sometimes a straitjacket may be necessary, and that's what medications are in many cases. They're not really medicines. They don't really cure anything.
Well, I mean, like, okay, I guess I have my own personal opinion because my dad is on medications. And
what does he take? What does he take? What does he take?
He takes a medicine called... I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it. Often.
Okay, is it healing some sickness in his body?
It's not healing a sickness, but there is some kind of dopamine that is produced in the brain that is too active. And when you don't have that working properly, this medication helps it to work properly.
Okay, so the medication manages...
Clozapine, actually, is the name of the medication.
Yeah, the medication then manages a problem. It doesn't heal anything, right?
No, that's correct.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it is with psychiatric drugs, because there isn't really, they aren't medicines that cure a sickness. They are substances that affect brain activity. When I mentioned alcohol, of course, alcohol affects brain activity differently than these do, but it's not a bad analogy in that alcohol is a foreign substance that you can put into your bloodstream that will have an effect on your brain activity. Some people like the effect. Some people feel better afterwards. Some people get more violent, of course. I mean, but the point is, it's not something your body needs, and it isn't something that's healing anything. It changes
your brain activity. Well, I agree. I think that they do need it. I think there are some people that do need that medication in order for them to function.
So what do you think people did before there were these medications and had these problems?
They were probably classified as demon-possessed.
Maybe some of them
were.
I mean,
my dad listens. I mean, he hears voices all the time.
Uh-huh.
But how do I say that it's the medic, that there's something imbalanced in his brain, or that it's spiritual? I don't know.
I think it's well, that's just the point. That's just the point. Yeah, in biblical times, Jesus and the apostles encountered lots of people who, if they were in our modern society, we would put them on medications, right? But you're right. They did think of them as demon-possessed, and they cured them. They cast the demons out of them. Now, I don't believe that everybody who's on medications is demon-possessed. Again, I'm sure I'll be misquoted about that. I believe some people are demon-possessed, and I think the ones who are, in many cases, would be misdiagnosed as having something that medication should handle. You know, I mean, if your dad, without the medications, would have signs of demon possession, I'm not going to say he's demon possessed, but I would wonder, how do we know he isn't? Was that tested? How was that tested? You know. Pardon?
Do you have an idea of how it's tested? I have no idea.
Well, that's just it. It's not the easiest thing to determine, is it? I mean, if somebody is demon possessed, how would you necessarily know that they were? Or let's put it this way: if they're not, how would you know for sure they weren't? For example, in the Bible, the Bible makes it very clear that some people have a physical, organic problem called epilepsy. I mean, the Bible mentions epilepsy as a sickness that was cured in some cases. But it also talks about demon-possessed people having fits and, you know, seizures and things like that. Now, if I were to watch this happen, how would I know? You know, especially if there was no medical testing to be done, how would I know whether they had a physical condition or it was a demonic condition? I might not be able to know that. Unfortunately, Jesus could tell, and he could heal both. You know, he could cast out demons and he could heal epilepsy and every kind of sickness. But the point is, we often don't know whether we're dealing with something that's demonic, but we figure that here the doctor can help with this medication, and it manages it in such a way that life is easier for everybody, including Dad. Well, okay, that could be a good thing. That could be a good thing. But I mean, we still, if we're missing an important spiritual component that is present and masking it because taking a medication makes life easier, at times we might be not really getting in touch with the real problem. Because, as I said, the doctors usually don't do, testing to find out if this medication is, you know, needed in the bloodstream or something like that. Sometimes they might, but a great number of times they don't bother. They just assume they know. And so I don't tell anyone to get off their medications. I'm saying that lots of times people might never need to get on medications if they had addressed the problems in the manner that corresponds with its actual spiritual cause. But once people are on medications, it's not the easiest thing in the world to get off, and some people may not want to get off. But I'm just saying, you know, it's often not really a physical condition that's being addressed.
Sometimes it is, too, and that needs to be addressed as well. If there is.
Well, I did mention that. I mentioned it could be a thyroid imbalance. It could be hypoglycemia. There are many chemical imbalances. There's hormonal imbalances that people go through. Sure. I mean, I know that. There can be physical causes of weird behavior. But what I'm saying is there isn't a proven physical cause for, let's say, schizophrenia. Or for manic depression. I mean, these things, psychiatrists will say, they'll tell you there's a brain chemistry imbalance, but they can't tell you what chemicals are out of balance because there aren't any that have ever been discovered. The brain chemistry imbalances of psychiatric patients, generally speaking, are not provable to be the cause of the behavior. The behavior might be causing the imbalance, and there may not even be an imbalance. Sometimes they think, well, if you just give them lithium, then the bipolar disorder will be, correct itself or something. Well, that means there was a lithium deficiency. Not really. The lithium did have an effect on the brain, but that doesn't mean that the brain needed lithium. So, I mean, there's an awful lot of things that people assume, and almost everybody has a relative or a friend who depends on psychiatric medications today and is sympathetic. And many times these friends, that is the ones who are not on the medication but know somebody who is, they know how much trouble that person had before they were on meds, and they realize that their life in many cases is better with them. Yeah. And so people do get an emotional reaction sometimes when someone says, well, maybe you don't need the meds, but if you don't, it's not for me to tell you what to do about it. That's for a doctor. The doctor is responsible for putting you on him. He's got to be responsible for taking you off him. I'm not going to take responsibility for that. Anyway, I appreciate your call, and I've talked to a lot of people with the same concerns you have. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're on every day, Monday through Friday, at the same time. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you think there's some value in what goes over the air here, you might want to help us pay the radio bills to stay on the air. If you want to do that, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can donate if you wish from our website, where everything at the website is free, but you can donate there too. It's at thenarrowpath.com. Again, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.